What I'll be discussing today can the talk itself can roughly be chopped into two halves, and the two halves are organized in the following sense: in that the beginning half will introduce, maybe introduction is even possibly the wrong word, but to present this idea that goes under the name of degravitation. And I said what I just said because there's several people here that have worked on it, or people that were formerly here that have worked on it, so I'm sure you're all familiar with it. And I'm going to discuss it in a particular context in which I wish to present the idea that degravitation, if you were to understand it in its full sense in which it's supposed to be understood, how it actually contains the kernel to address each of the cosmological constant problems with one simple assumption. So the first part of the talk would be just to if you like, motivate what's going to happen in the second part of the talk, which is to present a realization of this idea of degravitation, which is, in words, it's the idea of shutting gravity off at some very large length scale in a way that looks nothing like varying G Newton with space-time or anything like this. It's shutting gravity off for all sources that are larger than a particular IR length scale, which you obviously have to put in by hand. How this might actually be something that doesn't have to be constructed or put in, but might actually pop out of gravity when considered semi-classically. Could it be actually the effects of renormalization group running in the infrared? And that will be the second part of the talk. So, but before we get to that, I'd like to just motivate this idea of degravitation. Before we even motivate it, we actually have to understand what it is that what it is that it's doing, and why I believe, and I wish to show you in the next 5 minutes, why it's actually a very compelling candidate solution to the cosmological constant problems, plural. Okay. So, what are the cosmological constant problems? First, we have to explain why it is not of order unity in Planck units. So to really just, you know, flesh this part of the problem out, so we know from the modern perspective on gravity is that it's an effective field theory. It appears non-normalizable because it's an effective field theory. And there are all sorts of terms consistent with the symmetries that you could write down at any particular order, such that the cosmological constant appears quite naturally at the level of the Einstein-Hilbert equations. But the problem with that is that it's a number you have to tune such that if you were to tune it, once you consider the effects of matter treated quantum mechanically, that number likes to get detuned and gets driven up to order unity in Planck units very quickly. So if you were to try to tune it at the level of your tree level action, at the next loop level, you have to tune it again. At the next loop level, you have to tune it again. And you can forget about dynamics. Once you turn on dynamics, it's a non-tunable problem. It cannot be tuned away. And the reason that's a problem is that, well, if this were of order unity, the universe would not look anything like what we see today, in that it would have just stayed in deep within the quantum gravity regime, or would have just asymptotically entered its de Sitter phase in one Planck time. So the idea was, at some point, well, maybe it's something like gravity we're not understanding. Maybe this there's some symmetry that sets this number to zero. I don't know. Maybe supersymmetry. Great. So we sort of wished this problem away for about in a better part of all better part of, you know, the history of our subject up until about the late 90s. And then we came across this annoying fact of nature. And I believe it is at the level of, you know, almost conclusively, undeniably, it appears as if the universe's acceleration universe expansion is accelerating in a manner that is strongly suggesting that it's being driven by a cosmological constant. The equation of state parameter, unless we find some time dependence of it, which is a very interesting possibility that I will like to get into later, it looks like it's being sourced by something that looks like which looks a lot like a cosmological constant, but with a magnitude that is spectacularly tiny and unnatural in our theories. So these are two logically independent problems. And this one has often been referred to as, you know, one of the biggest catastrophic failures of our theories in modern time. What's less appreciated by particle physicists, but is widely appreciated by cosmologists, is that there's a third aspect to it, and it's just as severe, which is why it is only starting to dominate now. And what that actually boils down to is the fact that we look out there today, and we see the universe doing what it's doing, and we can see all the luminous matter that's out there, and then we infer whatever's dark matter. Essentially, The non-clustering component of the energy budget of the universe is of the same order, okay, it's of the same order as what looks like matter. But we know that they redshift very differently. One decays as the power of 1 over a cubed if it's matter, or 1 over a fourth if it's radiation, the other one is constant. So if they're the same order of the magnitude today, then at some initial time when this stuff was created, it had to be tuned to one part in a to the cubed. So that's depending on when this happened. If it happened at the end of inflation, for example, that's already another 10 to the minus 70 tuning. And if that tuning were any different, we would have entered our asymptotically de-Sitter phase long before we're here to ask the question, which needs to happen over the order of several billion years at least. So these are the three aspects of the cosmological constant problem, as I presume everybody here appreciates. And so solving even one of them would have been a major success. And I think it's a relatively uncontroversial statement to say that, you know, the inability to solve these problems was quite a lot of the underlying motivation to look to take seriously that this the idea that this problem is paraphrased away in the context of the string landscape, which, by the way, you know, may or may not be forced on us, but it's significantly a major motivation underlying this approach. Okay, and I'm not going to get into that any further. It's a choice of taste at this point. But what I would like to discuss now is that there's this idea called degravitation, which was designed to solve this part of the cosmological constant problem. Turns out that implicitly it contains within this assumption this particular, it explains why the cosmological constant has this particular magnitude. And we'll see it actually makes this a tautology, which is very interesting, which is something that I would like to show in a second. And it alleviates this part of the cosmological constant problem because what it does is it makes vacuum energy decay. Not redshift, but decay. So, and we'll see all of this in a couple of slides. And so what is this degravitation idea? So the idea is, well, what if Newton's constant isn't really this universal coupling, but it couples differently to different sources? What if? It's the game. And in this paper by Diwali, Gabadadze, and Schiffman, in a particular context, they stumbled upon what was later christened and elaborated on in this paper by Arkani, Hamed, Diwali, Dimopoulos, and Gabadadze, was christened as degravitation, which is the idea that G-Newton is a scale-dependent coupling such that it's designed to knock out all sources. It's such that if it couples to sources with a characteristic wavelength larger than some infrared scale, it's another tuning you put in there, that it goes to zero. And by this, I actually mean its product with M Planck squared. So G Newton compared to one scale, compared at laboratory scales, compared to scales larger than some IR scale, goes to zero, but that it reduces to the standard G Newton that we see in all of our experiments for all sources less than this characteristic wavelength. Seemingly a very strange modification to gravity. And what these authors, this argument that they proposed was, well, it's not so strange when you consider a condensed matter system. So, for example, Maxwell's equations in media, we know, have different properties than Maxwell's equations in vacua. And what we once thought of as, coupling the electrostatic potential, which determines how much a given charge distribution sources the electrostatic electromagnetic field, the electric field, we know that we can cook up situations where the dielectric constant now depends on, the frequency at which the source is being driven. So, in particular, if you had this permittivity constant such that it was frequency dependent and such that it went to infinity for long wavelength sources, then you have de-electrified. Well, essentially, that particular charge distribution will not source the electric field, and that's the physics of a high-pass filter. This was mused upon as a possible way to understand what happens could this happen in gravity. So, and by the way, this sort of idea and the sort of constructions that these authors and their collaborators have recently have been working on, this sort of way of thinking about it by some sort of macroscopic construction is a sort of underlying philosophy. What I wish to present is another take on this. And that it's actually kind of a model, not model independent, but it doesn't arise from a particular macroscopic construction, but might be an inherent property of the semi-classical treatment of gravity. So
what sets this scale capital?
Okay, so that depends on the particular model, and it's something that you put in by hand. So we'll see in the next slide specific examples where you see what sets that scale. So just getting up to that really quickly. if you're then essentially requiring that G Newton has these properties, then clearly it's going to turn into some covariant function of the D'Alembertian, some non-local covariant function of the D'Alembertian, such that the wish is, if you want this to be satisfied, you have to tweak its functional form such that it goes to zero for all, for its argument going to zero. So for all sources with wavelengths much, much greater than this scale, L, it causes this argument to go to zero, and so we want G Newton to have this particular functional form. And this will degravitate all sources corresponding to zero modes of the D'Alembertian. So we all know that in any space-time, the constant mode is an eigenvector of the D'Alembertian with eigenvalue zero. Clearly, this is something that you're hoping to solve by default. So great. How do you do this? So if you can do this, you've solved the bare cosmological constant problem. You basically made sources with wavelengths larger than this characteristic scale L decouple from sourcing curvature. So the next question is, how do you actually realize this filtering of gravity? So there's a proposal, and I'm not going to dwell too much on this because it's not the subject of my talk, but it's just providing some context. In this particular paper by Duvalli, Hoffman, and Khoury, they argued that you can actually construct, if you like, a class of filter functions for the spin 2 piece of your particular gravitational theory that looks a lot like this. But this is not to be taken too literally, where the scale M depends on your various constructions. So one particular construction is massive gravity. So you take Pauli Fiat, you take a Minkowski background, you deform your, you consider turning on a slight mass of the graviton, for which the only consistent way you can do that without generating ghosts is to introduce the Pauli Fiat modification to the Einstein-Hilbert tensor. And then you immediately realize from group theory that that you have extra polarizations, that you have 5 polarizations to the graviton now instead of your previous 2. And if you were to integrate them out and then substitute them back, if you were to integrate out the extra polarization, substitute them back into your equations of motion for the remaining spin 2 piece, maybe I went a little too, yes, I did, excuse me. What I was going to say, what I was just saying is effectively what is sort of elaborated upon here. If you integrate out these extra polarizations and you substitute them back in to the level of your Pauli Fiat's deformation of Einstein's equations, it looks like you have something that mimics this type of filter function for gravity. And the case where alpha is equal to a half, so in that case, the scale M corresponds to the graviton mass. Okay, there's another way. There's another context in which this arises, in these so-called DGP brain world constructions. And what you have in that situation is you have a brain embedded in a higher dimensional spacetime. The higher dimensional spacetime has its own Einstein-Hilbert term. The brain has its own Einstein-Hilbert term with one lower dimension. And taking into account bulk propagation of the gravitons on the brain will also induce this type of deformation to spin two part of your metric perturbation. So that's one way to see how this can arise. But however, there's some issues with these types of constructions. First of all, massive gravity doesn't exist, seemingly, right? Its nonlinear completion is very problematic. And by that, I mean, if you then work linearly, if you were to look at perturbations that are more than linear order away from Minkowski space, it becomes very unstable. Essentially, you move to something that's quite a lot different from Minkowski space at a time scale, much, much, much shorter than the graviton mass, surprisingly.
Can I just ask a question?
Sure.
What's the difference between what you're doing here and adding, just so I can sort of figure out what's going on. I mean,
absolutely.
People have been adding higher derivative terms to gravity for years. Now, what's the difference between doing that and what you're doing?
Okay, so adding higher derivative terms to gravity, in the level of your action, it's going to come suppressed with appropriate powers of some cutoff scale or some mass scale at which these higher derivative terms come in.
Well, that's what people say.
Right. Well, and so typically this is only going to become important in at high curvatures. This is an effect you want to appear in.
So you're doing the opposite of that?
Trying to get a modification to gravity in the infrared.
So you're adding non-local terms with boxes in the other place.
Possibly. You'll see that later, yes. I'm trying not to get to that at this point.
It's the equation. It's going to go in whatever box.
Yeah. You're adding the non-local terms rather than the local ones.
Yeah. Right. I'm trying to modify gravity in infrared. So higher derivative terms are not going to do that.
But you can't. This is like the ostrich putting his head in the sand.
Mm-hmm. In what sense?
Well, because you.
Great, tell me, no, what in.
She does not disagree.
You say, well, I'm more interested here in low energy gravity. And the rest is a mess, so I won't worry about it.
Sure, sure.
Well, but this is.
Well, you can't not.
Connected.
Well, sure, okay. Of course, I'd love to have a theory of quantum gravity in which all of this pops out, but we don't. And what we do have is this elephant in the room that's crapping a lot of crap. And it's smelling, it's starting to really smell in here. I think the fact of the matter is we do have to confront this, what this dark energy thing is, what this cosmic constant thing is, because depending on which coast you're on in the United States, you know, it's a huge problem. We have to really explain what this thing is. Okay, I can't explain, you know, where gravity, what the real origin of gravity is, or what the fundamental theory of gravity is. But what I am trying to, what we'll eventually get towards at this part of the talk is I'd like to show that perhaps some very mundane quantum effects, some very very standard quantum effects, might be generating IR relevant terms in gravity, such that dark energy is actually quite naturally understood. In that context, could it, in some sense, I'm actually about to propose what could be a very conservative solution to the cosmological constant problem. Possibly, right? I'm not saying that it's been solved, but this is the idea of so I think it, like I mentioned at the start, I just at the beginning part of the talk, I just want to show how this naive idea of degravitation has a lot of mileage. You can solve it has a candidate mechanism to solve each of the cosmological constant problems, and then I'll actually start to construct it as a possible semi-classical effect.
Yeah.
Sure.
One of the annoying things about this problem is that if you have any energy scale,
sure,
this comes from a phase transition, like Chiron QCD, that you raise it to the fourth power,
right,
you get this insanely large vacuum density.
Absolutely.
How are you going to deal with that?
This is what this is trying to resolve. It's trying to make those vacuum energy densities go away dynamically.
Like the Higgs, for
example. The Higgs VeV would still be around, but if you like, the zero mode piece of its potential will eventually decouple from source and curvature. That's the goal of this. Right? You try to essentially make all sources that are legitimate space-time zero modes disappear. Inflation doesn't count, because inflation happens in a burst in time. It's not a legitimate space-time zero mode. So this survives quite unmolested by the idea of degravitation. But the idea is you're trying to leave physics alone up till the horizon scale, but beyond the horizon scale, you want to change it such that you solve the cosmological constant problems. So this is just some sort of historical background, and this is, if you like, my motivation, which is in order to be self-consistent, in order to do any cosmology with this, we have to be able to take the nonlinear completion of this equation where you put G Newton to be a box, understand what you mean by the Bianchi identities in that context, and you know, really worry about where it comes from, because the stakes are actually quite high. Because, as I wish to now discuss, this simple assumption, making G Newton a function, a scale-dependent function such that it goes to zero for all long-wavelength sources, has a lot of mileage to it, okay? And how do we see that? So imagine now we just considered this particular filter function. So what I'm about to show you here is possibly an overly sophisticated writing of the fact that the cosmological constant is degravitated, but...
Is good or bad?
It's a good thing.
It's a good thing.
One assumption, solving two of the cosmological constant problems and addressing the third.
You don't want to buy a car, just a
lot. Usually it's the other way around, but okay.
Right. Right, no.
But okay, you say you mean that's a good thing.
Yes, you're buying a Tesla, you're not buying a something else.
You
buy nice clothes.
Your mileage per gallon, that's what you mean.
You have a lot of mileage, yes. One assumption. Yeah. Yeah, one assumption, knocking out two of the cosmological constant problems. Okay, this is the next two slides. Okay, and perhaps the reason, you know, this isn't so widely appreciated is because in the particular constructions that people were looking at, you cannot take these modifications to gravity seriously beyond linear order. Okay, and what I'm about to show is that this is actually demanded. Well, I'm about to show that how, if you were to take that seriously, you get a lot of mileage, and then I'm going to show how you can actually get these modifications to be understood in their full nonlinear glory as a quantum effect. It's just semi-classical gravity. Yes. Please.
This is a highly non-local field.
Yes.
So at what level is it non-local? When I do find the diagrams, or when I calculate the perihelion of isolated mercury?
Okay, so this depends on what the scale n is, right? And the idea is you're tuning that scale m. So, okay, so in your specific language, what if I wanted to compute graviton scattering?
You
can write down what this does to all of your diagrams in gravity in terms of spectral representation. All you've done is you've added a slight mass to the graviton, and if you're looking at all the experiments that we've done so far, it just doesn't appear if the scale m is such that it's smaller than the current horizon scale. So tuning you're putting in by hand. Okay? And if you talk to Ghia Davalli about it in the context of massive gravity, say it's a technically natural tuning. Because once you add a mass to the graviton, gauge field and matter field loops will give you corrections to that mass that are proportional to the graviton mass. So in some sense, it's a tuning, but it's technically natural. Quantum corrections don't spoil it for you. And what I wish to show next is it's even further than that. This is actually the net summation, non-perturbatively, of a certain class of quantum corrections. So it's, in fact, it is the result of quantum mechanics, is where I hope to get to next. Okay, so but let's just see what degravitation does very quickly. So if we just write down what this filter function looks like and you act on it with a particular source, just some very quick manipulations, realizing that this operator here is the inverse of Box plus M squared. If we act on this with Box, we'll plot a delta function minus M squared times this operator again. Okay, and so it's action on any source to make it look like the following. Okay, and of course we have to make sure that this modification is causal. Because you don't want, so you have to put in appropriate boundary conditions. You don't want the effect of the, what's happening to the source in the future affect what your source is doing now. So there's a choice that's being put in there. It's standard choice in all of our theories. And we know in particular that this integral is normalized as m squared times integral is normalized as 1. You can just, you can even see it from the level of the definition of what that Green's function is. So we can rewrite the above as a degravitated source, is just equal to the source itself minus this funny average quantity, which is essentially just this. It's not essential. There's maybe 8 or 9 ways you could write this down. The cheekiest way to see how the cosmological constant is degravitated is to just put in a 0 over here, and this makes this go to infinity, and so this goes to 0, and so the cosmological constant is annihilated by that source. But in this language, we see by just putting in a 0 mode here. In that case, we have lambda times 1 minus the average of 1, which is 1, and that goes to 0. So the cosmological constant is knocked out. Okay? And now let's go a little further and say, well, okay, this is actually, well, I've been a little cavalier about it. This is actually a nonlinear integral differential equation because you're trying to solve, well, you'll see it in a second. It's obvious. This depends on what the geometry is doing in throughout its entire history. The geometry appears here, and the geometry matter appears here. So it's a pretty intense equation, but let's just proceed with some formal manipulations. So this was just taking the trace of both sides to avoid any complexity of tensor structure and bring in the 1 over 1 plus m squared over box onto this side and look something like this. And then we can write that down now where this g is the inverse of this operator, unspecified as of yet, and we iterate. But we pick a particular type of source, which is a homogeneous, and realizing that, in essence, once you iterate this, we're going to get a sequence of ordered integrals. We can essentially do the same sort of thing we do when we're computing the time evolution operator in quantum mechanics and just formally write down a solution for what a step function might look like. So what is a step function as a source? So imagine you had a radiation-dominated phase, okay, which is traceless, so t is equal to 0, and at some point that energy organizes itself into potential energy, so it has a trace. So that's the step that appears. Okay, what does degravitation do to this source? Well, formally, this is the solution, and it's impossible to solve. But just by dimensional thinking alone...
Can I understand? What is that?
Oh, excuse me. Right, I'm really not explaining a lot of things. Right. So this is not essential. I mean, these things are essentially coordinate independent. Right, you can do this diffeomorphism in very quantum. But I'm trying to say that the source is just, if you like, the trace of a bubble, right? So this z is some. This is really messy. Okay, I can ignore this part. You can put it there too. But I'm trying to imagine a condensing of vacuum energy at some finite time.
It's not homogeneous.
No, right. So this is actually, I realize this is a typo that shouldn't be here. This is a toy model. It's a cartoon example. But in the end, it doesn't matter because the support is such that it vanishes outside the light cone anyway. And so you'll get the same answer. But in order to actually read write these ordered integrals in terms of, in order to have a distep, you have to assume a strictly homogeneous source. Okay? Spatially homogeneous source, right? Not temporally. Okay?
But then if that doesn't satisfy like energy momentum conservation, you just match it up here.
Well, it happens, right? I'm not saying matter, I'm saying the trace goes from zero to something. Yeah. That happened to start inflation.
You have some equation saying it's consistent.
Yeah.
You're just looking at the trace. You're not looking, you know, there's just a rearranging of energy, so it does that. Okay? And so this is formally what the curvature, and so by the way, this black triangle is telling you that the domain at which you're integrating this G0, the inverse of this operator, is from the observation point to the past light cone going back to when this energy density condensed. So clearly, and this is again, you don't need to solve anything to realize this. For a massless interaction in any space-time, the scattering cross-section is infinite, right? So this integral, this is basically telling you that the G0 has a divergent integral going into past infinity. If there's a mass, then of course it asymptotes to 1 over n squared. So you can see that this integral, if this time goes to the infinite past, just goes to 0. The source degravitates. We haven't even solved this thing, but you can immediately see what degravitation does. It takes curvature and just makes it go down over time with a characteristic time scale, not exactly as 1 over m, but it's what you effectively get is something that looks a lot like m squared t squared. Okay, so but you can infer the characteristic time scale as being this m. So if we now consider the example of a test source in a Minkowski background, this really is a cartoon example, and just put in what this is. Well, in Minkowski space, it's just you know what this is, and just integrate over some volume, you get this expression. So you have a decaying of space-time, so you have a decaying of vacuum energy density with this time scale, which is actually kind of slow. Because what you really want to do in all of this, remember we're trying to not affect gravity up until present, up to the present horizon scale. That means you want this m to be less than the current horizon scale, okay, the current one. It's some fixed scale. So if you demand that, then what you're saying is that this scale m is less than h0. So if you want an initially gut scale energy density to degravitate down to 10 to the minus 120, you'd have to wait till 16 times the age of the universe. Okay, so that's too slow. Okay, so if you kill the cosmological constant, right, then you have to again explain what dark energy is, right? So this is so this is where the next thing. The next incredible feature of this model comes in, which it makes.
So what you mean that if m is less 16 times smaller than Hubble today, then you're fine, then you can explain
everything. No. I'm saying that m has to be less than the current horizon scale, right? And if it is.
Why should it be less than current horizon
scale? So, because that means that you're not affecting gravity up till the current horizon scale.
Why not?
Yeah, you could, of course. You could. You could realize, I'm trying to be conservative here. Okay.
Well, but then maybe that's the problem with your assumption, that m could be much bigger than...
I think you've run into some pretty... I think you had a paper where you show that you run into trouble when you modify G Newton to...
But our paper, m could be bigger than Hubble.
But it can't be too much bigger, right? I mean, we already know that gravity... general relativity seems to work up to all scales approximating even a quarter of the sky.
Well, I mean, if you believe dark energy... If you believe that's lambda, what you're saying, then that's right. But
I would be even happier if m could be greater than h0. But I'm trying to be conservative here.
Okay.
Yeah. I would be very happy. You get much more mileage out of it.
But then, you need a much shorter scale than age of universe, right? For example, after any of the phase transitions, if you have any leftovers of those.
Yes. Exactly. Excellent point. Right. So no, absolutely. So if you have phase transitions that later then dump energy density, and you do need to degravitate it over a much larger scale. But I want to point out something here, which is that I picked a particular form of the filter function, right, which arises in particular constructs. I'm going to show how this comes out as a quantum effect. But you can get other functional forms that will have different characteristic behavior. So it's open. That's a problem. This is something that this doesn't address. Yes.
The violation of the Copernican cosmological principle in time occurs because in the Landesitian model, you plot rho versus time. You have a horizontal line, that's the lambda. And rho cuts through lambda the sun was full. Mm-hmm. This is absurd, okay? I don't understand how you get rid of this problem.
Okay, I'm not sure I understand what you're...
Do the lambda CDN line. Mm-hmm.
The coincidence problem, right, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Okay, so the coincidence problem arises from the fact that you have to... where does the coincidence problem come from? It comes from the fact that the vacuum energy density is a constant. Yes? So yeah, exactly. So if it were to decay in time, it is alleviated. Right? I'm not saying that this has solved it, but it's alleviated. What if vacuum energy density decays as a power of 1 over t? Instead of...
The thing is, you have to use lambda CDM to fit the data, if you believe that. And it fits it very well. The lambda is approximately constant.
There's a lot of priors you put in to say that it fits it very well, though. You see? There's a lot of theory dependence in these claims. I wouldn't be so sure about these claims.
Yeah, I suggest we let him continue, yeah. And then we can...
There's much we can debate about this, but there's a lot of problems that we have to still figure out. Okay, and as I wish to advertise at the beginning, you know, even solving one aspect of the cosmological dual constant problem would be a huge success. And the inability to do so has led people to paraphrase it away. And I would like to just present a mechanism that does two things in once, maybe to address something about the third. Okay.
Yes, you might have covered this before. Are there boundary conditions on this box plus r squared?
Yes. So the boundary conditions are you want causal evolution. So you don't want things in the future affecting your degravitated, what you're considering as your source in the present.
So this is a retarded...
Yes, absolutely. And that's... This particular header of the slide is what I'm rather... This is what actually possessed me to work on this for the better part of 3 years, actually, was this next thing that you're about to see. And it's the following. So we can again rewrite the degravitated energy, the effect of the filter function on a given source in the following manner. That's just a rewriting of what I wrote before. And now we consider a delta function source for the trace. Okay, so imagine a radiation dominated epoch, and then the energy organizes itself into having a trace, and then it reheats, so the trace is gone again. And if that happens over timescales much, much less than m, then you can just take this as a toy model. And if we work with a test source in a de Sitter background, okay, and just compute, we'll just put in a delta function. It's the easiest integral in the world to do. You get something that looks like this. Okay, so what was once a delta function now becomes a step function. Okay, there's a memory effect, and it should be obvious. It's a non-local action that you're doing to a particular source. And if we expand in powers of this scale m, what it looks like is that even after the source is long gone, so you can imagine that this burst of trace happened at one point, but now it's gone. So normally you'd say there's nothing left. The filter function forces you to inherit a memory effect of it, such that the relevant scale that you're seeing, the relevant magnitude of it you obviously have the actual scale of the potential that you had during inflation up in front, but it's suppressed by this power of m squared, and there's this function of with dimension time that then subsequently decays. If we were to let me just set this up again. So we computed a test source in a de Sitter background, and now we're going to take this de Sitter background h going to zero limit. So this really does approximate something that was effectively flat, and then there's this burst of energy density, and we're looking at how that source's geometry. This is a cartoon calculation, but the very fact that your energy densities are suppressed by this m squared over m Planck squared demands that if you are then to say that it doesn't if you're saying that degravitation does not affect gravity up till present horizon scales, then you are forced to contend that this scale m squared over m Planck squared, which is already 10 to the minus 120, sets the natural scale at which you will inherit the memory of energy of the energy density during inflation. So degravitation says that even if you have nothing, so if you kill the bare cosmological constant and you have nothing that looks like a cosmological constant left, if inflation happened, anything happened, if you just had, this is just one particular example, this memory effect is generic, right? I just picked a cheeky example to flesh this out. If you had a burst of inflation, that energy density still remembered today, suppressed by this factor, m over m Planck squared today. So that's telling you, that's setting you a very natural scale for this afterglow cosmological constant. And in this way, dark energy becomes a tautology. Right, you're saying that you want to get rid of the cosmological constant problem, but in a way that doesn't affect gravity up to the present scale. That criteria then tells you get that scale in Planck unit squared as a natural scale for what looks like dark energy. It's very, very beautiful factor, this simple modification to Einstein's equations. So working phenomenologically is what we've done, because there's a lot of issues you can have with what I've done to what people have done to Einstein's equations or how I've used them. Degravitation appears to solve 2.5 aspects of the cosmological constant problem. And maybe you can actually, depending on your taste, make this fraction 1/10 or 1/100th. Because this is supposed to refer to the coincidence problem.
But you're still putting M.
M is a choice. And you have to tune it to be incredibly small in this case, if you were. Absolutely, it's a choice. Then you have to ask, whatever particular construction that gives you this, is this a natural choice? Is it technically natural? Is it assuming what you're trying to solve?
And the other question, yes. What is delta?
It's just some order of unity, and then it's a decaying exponential.
More than high
decay. Yeah, it decays as a scale of this m again, right? So it's time, right? So it effectively, up to a present horizon scale, it won't have changed more than an order of unity. Okay, so that's the thing. So that's the statement that you can still actually. So there's a tension that's starting to appear here, which is that if you want to explain what dark energy is, it very naturally pops out of this model. But then if you don't want it to decay too much, essentially the coincidence problem arises because vacuum energy density doesn't decay. But in this case, it does. But you want it to decay fast enough. And in that case, then you do have to get into model-specific ideas. This filter function clearly doesn't do it. It decavitates too slow. So these other sources of energy density, like phase transitions, and will come back and bite you in this case. But what I wish to show is that there are other possibilities of getting degravitation where that filter function might change and could become very fast. I don't know. I'm just presenting an idea, presenting an idea and then providing preliminary evidence that this might actually be the consequences of some IR-relevant terms that we're missing in gravity. So if any of these claims that I've just advertised, what I'm about to do next, you can actually just ignore if you like and just consider what I just presented to you now, because I think this is actually a rather interesting set of observations about an idea that people have been having for about 10 years now, is that you solved two of the cosmological constant problems. Amazing, but does it actually work? And a lot of people think the answer is no. So one of the papers actually never even got accepted for publication because people are saying, what is this? How can you do this to gravity? Okay? So, and when I put out this paper, the reason I worked on this, which, sorry if I'm going to get a little personal, I worked on this for 3 years essentially because I was trying to get my first paper published. And I did. And so here we go. So, yeah, but if you're a young researcher like me, you don't get jobs if you don't publish your papers. So, but yes, it was out on the archives for about a year. And
what's the time scale of the decay? So another Hubble parameter?
It depends on what the scale M is, and that's a choice. So I'll give you an example. So if you were to consider it to be massive gravity, then the filter function has a particular form, and the scale M, if you choose for it not to affect gravity up until the current horizon, then the scale of the decay is a Hubble time. So
today's
Hubble time. Today's Hubble. There's no such thing, but sorry, go ahead.
Okay. Suppose if you take the cosmological constant and you expand it in terms of h, the problem is you get one term which is linear in h, and then you get an h squared term. The reason that you can't just add mass to gravity is because of that linear h term. You know what I'm talking about?
Can you repeat what you just said again? I'm sorry.
Okay. If you take gravity,
yes,
Lagrangian for gravity,
yes,
you add the cosmological,
yes,
and you expand gravity in terms of g mu equals delta mu plus h mu,
right?
Then the cosmological constant looks like h and h mu mu plus a term h squared,
yes,
plus a term h cubed.
Right.
If you just suppress that h mu mu term, then you've got a gravitational theory with mass, right? But of course, you've done something awful to the cosmological,
yes,
constant,
yes,
right?
Yes.
You've done something dreadful to,
yes,
it. And you've lost everything in general.
Yes, yes.
But what you're doing, I'm just asking.
Yes.
Aren't you really just doing that, but you're doing it with non-locality and disguising it from me?
I'm actually going to tell you something. It's actually even worse. It's even worse than this. It's even more of a cop-out. I'm about to show you that what I've written up is actually just this equation. Excuse me. That this looks a lot like... is actually paraphrasing. That's all I'm saying, is that it's a paraphrasing of this equation. So, and this is the subject of this.
Sorry, what's the
right-hand
side?
It's the vet. This is saying that this is equivalence,
yeah.
Right? This equation is equivalent to this equation. We're not
that's
gene.
Not an equation.
It's not an equation. It's probably
the most important thing of an equation is obviously the equal sign. Oh, excuse me. Pardon me. G mu nu.
Okay.
G.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that you're throwing a box into the region nu and making it non-local by taking it out again.
So one way of saying what I'm about to say, and this is a perspective that you could have, you don't have to have it, I'd rather not have it, is the effects of renormalization group running will induce resonant masses to the graviton in the infrared, as it flows into the infrared, consistent with diffeomorphism invariance. That's what's one way of seeing what I'm saying. Another way of seeing what I'm saying is what I'll get to is that you're just renormalizing. There's another mass scale in the problem that you put in by hand. It's going to turn out to be of the order of 0.3 electron volts. The same number that makes people think that there's something to do with neutrinos in the cosmological constant. Such that the quantum corrections of a particularly gruesome non-local scalar field that you can integrate out induces a Wilsonian running for G Newton and lambda, such that both of these quantities flow to zero and the product flows to zero. But acting on other sources of energy momentum, it makes G Newton look like a filter function. And that's what's important to explain what dark energy is when it acts on the inphoton field. So the idea is that this is actually just a semi-classical effect. Whether our techniques, our calculational techniques, can handle what I'm about to try and ask is another question. So I will present within one particular context, which is working with standard heat kernel techniques. I will provide one example, which you can tear apart if you want. I don't really care. This provides an example as a proof of concept that one can engineer a running of G Newton such that it satisfies it. So if you like, this is a game. Okay? We know that in any field theory, depending on what field contents you add, you can make the beta function go up or down. You know, it's your choice. So the question I'm asking is it possible to engineer a field content such that when you couple it to gravity, it induces a Wilsonian running of G Newton such that it gives you degravitation? So this is something, I guess I have 15 minutes left, but I'll try and breeze through this. This is something that I think a lot of people will rather like, because to me we know that coupling constants run in an interacting field theory, and typically we're only working in Fourier space. We're typically just computing scattering amplitudes and inverse Fourier transforming them and computing effective potentials and things like this. But we're also entitled to work in configuration space. Why on earth do you do that? I don't know, but Barvinsky likes to do that. And the way he does that is he just says, well, give me my coupling constants. I'm essentially just going to, wherever I see a power of k squared, I'm just going to put in a box at the level of all of the quantities that I'm computing. And if you like, what this does is delocalizes the vertices. It makes the equations of motion non-local. And that's great. That's what quantum mechanics does for us. Okay? And let's run through an example where we really appreciate how this is actually something that we've all been doing since we learned quantum field theory. So, if you consider an electrostatic potential between a point charge force and an infinitely heavy point charge and a light charge scattering off of it, okay, we compute the at zero momentum transfer the inverse Fourier transform of the scattering amplitude. Okay, so which is given by the following. So if 4 pi alpha is truly a constant, we get back Maxwell's equation, right? We get back that the electrostatic potential is just 1 over r. But we know that the coupling, in fact, does run. And the net effect is, well, there's two ways to look at it. One way is to just say, well, it takes the charge and effectively smears it out into a charge distribution that looks like the following. Okay? So what quantum mechanics does is it smears things out. That's the colloquial way of saying it's a colloquial way of encapsulating quantum effects. And, you know, you'd have gotten the same thing if you just made this alpha function of box. Okay? And there's another way of looking at it, which is that, if I now take the limit, the fictitious limit, because I'm trying to make quantum mechanics relevant at large scales, if I look at the fictitious theory where the electron mass goes to zero, Okay, these quantum mechanics actually stretches out to some quite macroscopic length scales, and we can get the quantum corrected equations of motion going on here. So one of two things has happened. Either the source has changed or your Gauss law has changed. But one thing is clear, non-locality is at work. Okay, this is quantum mechanics in position space. And that's great. We know this. This is something very, very standard. And we ask, well, you know, therefore, you know, so if the idea is that, you know, in gauge theory, you can just take your alphas, instead of putting k-squares, just put boxes there, could we do that to gravity? So now I want to just, you know, to cheekily throw up an example in two dimensions, very suggestive example, a useless example, but let's look at it nonetheless. In two dimensions, 2 plus epsilon, actually, which makes it even more absurd, gravity is a renormalizable theory, okay? And in 32 years ago, Duff and Christensen computed what the one loop beta function was for gravity, depending on the particular field content in which you were coupling gravity to. So these numbers, they're the number of massless spin NS fields, and these are the number of massive spin NS fields. That's the beta function for gravity in two dimensions. So if this can be engineered to be positive, we have the celebrated UV fixed point at this particular value of G. So once we have a beta function, we can integrate it. And it integrates to this. Okay? Looks a lot like what Diwali, Khoury, and Hoffman were proposing. Okay?
You're getting into a minefield called field theory. Mm-hmm. Because you have to be careful with this function. Why does she need origin?
Why do you say that?
Because you get additional singularities, which are not allowed.
You're saying that if you were to write down the spectral function of this of the resulting propagator, you'd have negative norm states.
Well,
I
get additional poles.
Not in this case.
But these poles violate the Kropotkin rule.
Not in this case.
Also.
But that is a, so exactly.
The
your point.
Choice you made.
No. The point that you're making is a very good one, and the point is the following: if you make G Newton run. Right, you can think of it as if you were to write down the spectral function for the resulting propagator that you end up with, that spectral function had better satisfy certain properties to make sure you haven't violated unitarity. And in the cases that I'm looking at, it's the case. Unitarity is definitely a concern. So I'll tell you exactly. So if we would ignore that this came from this, and if you were to just consider this as looking, just rewind back a little bit and think of the filter function that Diwali, Khoury, and Hoffman were proposing, this exact point puts constraints on what this alpha is. This alpha has to be greater than or equal to zero and strictly less than one, precisely because of unitarity. So that's a concern, obviously, and it's satisfied in this case.
14 years ago, I published a couple of papers on a non-local quantum gravity. Mm-hmm. It supposedly solved a cosmological constant problem. And I carefully worked out how to do this without violating quantum truth. It was not popular 14 years ago. I doubt it's even popular today.
Well, I'll take a look at it just see what you did.
Yeah. But it's very complicated because quantum field theories are very, local quantum field theories are very strict scenario. There's very little room to win.
Absolutely, completely agree. And you could, but there are certain contexts where you, let me provoke you with the following statement. If you pick up a quantum field theory textbook, you're sort of given the assumption, you're given the idea that, oh, wow, great, we understand everything about quantum field theory, right? It's all like this, all high-energy effects can be written down in terms of an effective field theory where you have high-dimensional operators expressed by a particular mass scale, and that we've computed all the renormalization of scalar field theories in certain dimensions of, you know, you think there's a lot that's known, but you know, there's a lot of calculations that we haven't done yet. It's not that we don't know about them. There's a lot of things that are floating around, even within this framework, that are surprising. And there are contexts in which the assumptions are relaxed a little bit. And then you see new things, right? So decoupling could be relaxed, for example, right? In which case, you'll see new things in the infrared. This is precisely trying to sort of nail upon that, okay? So I agree with you completely. Local quantum field theory is a very, very strict.
Yeah. In the 60s, a lot of work was published on how you can relax quantum field theory.
Mm-hmm.
And string theory came in, and it was all forgotten. And it's not on the archive.
No, well, it shouldn't be forgotten. It's very important.
And, it's, and the way things are working, if they don't find the Higgs particle, for example, we're going to have to go back and redo it.
I'd be very happy if you know provides employment for us. Or some of the same.
Well, go back to your previous slide.
Sure.
The answer is very strange. You've got this g of k squared, and now if d equals two, is then you've got a plus.
It's five, this is this is okay. So these are all okay. So these are all depending. So this is again to stress a sort of suggestive toy example of gravity.
Where people said,
so these come from your integration constants for this equation.
It could be
either plus or minus.
So m squared is just an integration.
It's an integration constant, yes.
And if d equals 2?
Then it's nonsense.
No.
Yeah? So it's in d, it's 2 plus epsilon dimensions.
Function, okay.
So why should one not be in Barrett with this example that you have given? Because this example is in 2 dimensions.
Yeah.
And we have something similar to what you started with in that. So I would say, like, if you start with 4 dimensions,
mm-hmm.
you do not get the answer which you're looking for.
But I do, and that's where I'm going next.
But epsilon is equal to 2.
Yeah.
But you can't put epsilon equal to 2, right?
No.
Maybe you can then do anything.
But some people do that.
Well, you can put it as small as you want, but it's okay. I don't really want to stress on this too much. It's something that you know you stumble upon on your way to you know what you're looking for that I think is interesting, and you know maybe it's not. I mean, then it becomes a question of opinion. So, but what I'm about to show you in the next, I hope, 5 minutes is a proof by construction in 4 dimensions that you get something very interesting. Okay, so, but let's just. So there was a concern. So when this idea of degravitation came out, a lot of people said, "Ah, rubbish! Doesn't satisfy the Bianchi identities in a general background because obviously the operation of covariant contraction doesn't commute with the D'Alembert in a general space-time. So clearly, new constraints are going to be imposed if this is a covariantly conserved quantity, but." Really, the correct perspective is to be that there's not that there's new constraints implied that this is the only Bianchi identity you have, because precise reason is that this is to be thought of as actually this in disguise. So the operation of covariant differentiation is not just to commute with the expectation value. And to see that explicitly, we know immediately why that is because the VEV of T mu nu comes from varying with respect to the metric of the effective action, okay? Not the classical action, in which case d mu, t mu nu, of course, vanishes, but the effective action, which has an expression you could compute in whichever your favorite way of computing it is, and we know it contains all sorts of non-local junk. Okay, people tell you that it, or you might think that it doesn't, but we know it contains all sorts of non-local junk, and people have actually computed it in whatever context that they're interested in. It's if you're computing the infinite renormalizations, of course, you just have local counterterms, but there are finite pieces that could become very relevant, that are clearly going to be non-local and capture things, possibly like particle production, black hole radiance, vacuum polarization, which is where I'm headed to. So the question is, could we make this work in 4 dimensions? The idea that I just could degravitation actually happen in 4 dimensions? And to this, this again is not essential for what I'm following, but I think it's a very valid point to just bear in mind. Gravity is the only force for which we actually directly measure its strength in the UV. Unlike other forces where we compute, where we do scattering experiments deep into the IR and look at the couplings run into the UV, gravity is the only a force who we have to do, we can compute its coupling in the UV. And by that, I mean we have to do direct Cavendish experiments. We need to know the masses of the two things to jiggle them about to see what the coupling is. So so what we're basically asking, in to cut a long story short, is can gravity have a positive beta function such that it reduces to the standard 1 over m Planck squared as this floating scale mu goes to all scales that are accessible, and then it flows to zero. Or m Planck times g Newton flows to zero at very large scale. That's very.
So for you, the UV is macroscopic scale, lab scale.
For me, yeah, lab scale.
Relative to cosmology.
You go to the cosmology, absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, okay, maybe I'll breeze through this, but this is just sort of technical details of how g Newton actually gets renormalized by standard matter field. So if you were to take a scalar field and you were to integrate it, all this is just showing you one particular technique of computing how integrating at a scalar field renormalizes G Newton, but in a way that's effectively useless in the infrared, because this is the resulting renormalization group running of it. And this, if this reference scale is a laboratory scale, you've got n Planck's that appear here. So in the IR, nothing. In the IR, this goes to zero. You get the standard G Newton that you always had. But some people have wondered at the possibility of, if you have enough of these scalar fields, how you can actually make this drag down the fundamental quantum gravity scale to much lower energy. So this is the large N stuff by Gia is looking at precisely this observation in this context. But I don't really care about that. We asked the question, what is it that would affect degravitation? So if we were to, I guess I breezed over the details, but one gets what the effective action is by taking this proper time integral of the heat kernel, okay? And maybe the technical detail. I was hoping to actually go through at least the conceptual background, but given the time constraints, I hope people will allow me just discussing this in words. This heat kernel you can compute in a curvature expansion for a given field content coupled to gravity. So that makes sense. If you take a field theory, minimally coupled to gravity, you integrate it out, you're only going to get curvature invariants, right? And this is the relevant series that you pull out. And it's this coefficient and this coefficient that you're interested in, because that tells you how the cosmological constant is renormalized. That tells you how G Newton is renormalized. So tau is the proper time that you're... So this is in the so-called proper time formalism of... Right, so what is this heat kernel? So you're basically trying to evaluate a functional determinant through it. It's not physical time, if that's what you're asking. So if we were to then compare this effective action to the bare Einstein-Hilbert term, we can extract exactly how G Newton is renormalized. It's given by this following integral, right? So recalling that the effective action is given by the proper time integral of this quantity, this tells you how G Newton is renormalized. So we can compute the Wilsonian running by effectively, so this is if you like the UV cutoff, to cut off all the high momentum divergences in your loops. And to compute the Wilsonian running, you put an IR cutoff too, because that just suppresses integration of all IR modes. So you're basically only integrating out the UV modes. This is the truest way to stay true to Wilson's original prescription. And you can compute what the running of G Newton looks like. And it looks like the following. So this is all general. Nothing is model specific right now. So if you put what G is for a standard scalar field, you get the answer that I had before, and fermions, massive vector fields, so on and so forth. So as we've seen, or maybe as I will just assert, the G of tau that you get from integrating out standard fields and standard couplings doesn't really do anything interesting for us in the infrared. And why should it? Because why should standard matter fields do anything in the infrared? I mean, maybe that's a little too crass a statement, because there are other ways in which they can come and bite you if you have anomalies, for example. But if you'll just allow me that breezing over. But perhaps the place to look is theories where there's some non-trivial stuff going on in the infrared. And so this may not look like it does that, but if I have an action that's modified in this following way, this pops out of the so-called DGP constructions, Diwali-Gabadadze, Parati brain world models. If we integrate them out, we'll get this function of G of T, which I assert, if you just work through the details, results in a filter function of this form for particular choices of this pattern for the scale M that looks something like it degravitates. So when this goes to zero, this whole thing gets killed. And okay, the reason you shouldn't take that too seriously is that this only happened on the so-called self-accelerated branch. And so what's actually doing this is nothing particularly physical. It's just a tachyon that's causing this strange behavior. But now look at this action, okay? And so this is the last slide, actually second to last slide. So if you take this action, it's quadratic. So these what's surprising about working in these heat kernel with these heat kernel techniques is that you can actually do a lot of these integrals exactly. You can get very cheeky with the type of modified propagators you can explore. It looks crazy. I'm going to elaborate upon it by the time I get to here. But if I were to take this action and integrate it out, it results in an RG flow. So this is work reported on in a paper whose reference I provided a little earlier. It results in a renormalization group flow such that M Planck times G Newton goes to zero and lambda times G Newton goes to zero, independent of your cutoff scheme.
What is
some field that you then integrate out. It's a fictitious field you introduce, probably in the dark section. You don't want it to couple to anything else. Okay. Like I said, this is in the spirit of a proof of concept. I'm trying to engineer field content that will do this. Okay. And I just want to get to some results and then saying how I think that this, there's probably other ways to do this too, but this is just what allows to make a positive claim. And the functional form in a particular scheme gives you a filter function that looks like the following. So this is degravitation affected through normalization group running. And if you were to write this in terms of its spectral function, what you've done is you've induced a mass gap for gravity in the infrared. And then you might ask, well, how does that make any sense? How is this consistent with diffeomorphism invariance? Because we all know that in gauge theories, when you gauge invariance protects the photon from receiving mass corrections under RG flow, it's not true in gravity. Consistent with diffeomorphism invariance, you can generate masses under RG flow because the space through which you bounce around in RG flow in gravity is infinite dimension. It's not like in a gauge theory, which is renormalized, you only go through a finite number of dimensions. And there are examples, you can write down all sorts of curvature invariants where there appears to be a mass where the graviton appears to be a mass when you perturb it around that particular point. And the point is, if you're just integrating out heavy fields, you're not going to introduce ghosts, you're not going to violate unitarity. This is a very, very conceptually clean way of doing this. But the reason I won't actually make this claim in all of its generality is that it's more likely to be a series of resonant masses generated under RG flow because under a different scheme, you'll get a different filter function. But that's normal. We see that in quantum field theory all the time. You know, you get logarithmic divergences or quadratic divergences. The point is there's certain things that are physical. And whatever is physical has to be independent of your scheme. And so independent of whichever scheme you pick, these two things are satisfied. And you end up with some filter function that gives you what looks like degravitation. And so...
what do you exactly mean by independent? Do you mean... qualitative behavior persists?
Yes, that called this, these
the
two things.
Schemes might give different functions.
Functional forms, exactly. And maybe I shouldn't say scheme independent, I should say the schemes that I've tried.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but yes.
But then comparing it with the data, how does the scheme independence?
Right.
What are the questions that we can ask that are scheme independent?
Well, you can't talk. Okay, so whenever you have scheme dependence in your calculation, something's up, right? What are you doing? This tells you that the quantity that you're computing is not physically reliable. Okay, the problem is gravity or any quantum field theory or effective field theory we're trying to compute dimension full, running dimension full couplings, that there's an irreducible scheme dependence there. Irreducible. You can go ask Robert Procacci about it. Or if he's here.
Yes.
Oh, you know about this. So there's an irreducible scheme dependence. And so, but you try to ask questions that are independent. But you try to ask things that are relatively independent. So this is all I can say at this point. I hope to be able to say it much more quantitatively with other calculations. But, Nathan?
So RG flow generate all sorts of terms involving different powers and different combinations of the curvature. But in flat space, all of those terms would vanish, whereas a mass term...
And we're also going into the IR, so particularly the higher curvature invariants are going to be less and less relevant. What is actually happening in one of these examples is that you're generating a term. Okay, so typically, typically the kind of term that you generate... So if you were normalizing G Newton, 1 over G bare is equal to, say, 1 over G renormalized is equal to 1 over G bare. If you took out a standard scalar field, okay, you would get a floating renormalization that looks like the following form. What's happening here is that you have an extra mass scale with this little m is up here, such that you get something that looks like the following. Okay, there's another mass scale that's causing the qualitatively different behavior in the infrared. Or you're trying to go for that, is the precise thing to say. Okay?
You RG flow, you generate a mass term for the graviton.
I wouldn't make that claim. But it's one way of looking at it. I would say that you actually generate, you keep your massive... In this case, if this is the exact answer independent of the scheme, then I would say, yes, you've generated a mass gap for the graviton. But in another scheme, you get this answer, and if you write down the spectral representation of this operator, what you'll find is you've generated a tower of resonant masses. So you still have the massless graviton, but you have others too. But if all of your calculations show this, then you've actually generated a mass gap for the graviton. But clearly this shows that that's not the case.
Okay. Just the terminology, what do you mean by resonant?
Okay, so if you were to write down... okay, well, what I mean by resonant mass is if you write down the graviton propagator in terms of a spectral representation, right, you'd have some rho of s ds. That this rho of s is not a delta function in s. Okay, so it looks like you're propagating massive gravitons if they're poles away from zero, depending on the spectral function. That's essentially what I mean by resonant. Okay, now I'm about to summarize here. So now you say, well, what the hell is this? So my answer is, well, first of all, like I said, the goal was that this is a proof of concept, but if we stare at this long enough, you start to see that, oh, maybe this isn't so weird, because operators of this form might actually be a cheeky way to non-perturbatively resum things that have been computed in QFT. So that you would get operators that, so if you imagine a massless scalar field, but with some higher order terms in its potential, then the finite contributions to the effective action receive corrections that go like 1 over box to the V. It's in this paper by Barvinsky and Mukhanov, and a bunch of other papers by Barvinsky before. Okay? So if this is, and this is a particular loop order. So if this is what you get at first loop order, then clearly at second loop order you get 1 over box squared, and the third you get 1 over box cubed. And let's say, you know, I'm just going to wave my hands and say, you know, whenever you get anything non-perturbative, it's going to be an exponential that goes on. But that's the idea, is that could this be a non-perturbative resummation of all the finite contributions to your effective action? Could this be the effective action of particle production? The Schwinger effect for a de Sitter background, which would, you know, maybe relate to what guys like Polyakov and Antoniadis and Motola have been thinking. I don't know. You could also think of this as a non-perturbative sequence of a, so excuse me, there should actually be a box out here first, right? A non-perturbative resummation of loop counter terms in scalar non-commutative field theories. I don't want to get into that interpretation too much either, but non-local terms in effective action are guaranteed to exist. We just don't know how to compute them, so not everyone knows about them. But I think it's a pretty nifty idea that loop effects could solve rather than aggravate the Kolmogorov constant problems. And if you like, the claim of what I'm making in this talk is the Kolmogorov constant problems are solved by this idea that is nothing other than an epiphenomenon of semi-classical quantum gravity. That's it. There's nothing more there. And providing some preliminary evidence that this might be the case. And by the way, I just looked at a particular example which I know how to calculate with because I happen to have the right textbooks in front of me. But could there be other operators that induce RG flow deep into the IR? And Motolo and Antoniadis have shown that there is. If you look at the trace anomaly effect of action, okay, and what is that? That is effectively the fourth order action that you have to add to account for the trace anomaly in for a conformally coupled field. You do also induce a running. You do induce a running such that of G Newton times lambda flows to zero in the infrared. However, G Newton flows to infinity. So it's not. So in their work, it's not quite degravitation. It's actually regravitation or something. But the point is, the cosmological constant is times G is what actually is sensitive to curvature, and that goes to zero too. So it's not an independent discovery by any means. And could these horizon scale effects be an inbuilt figure, inbuilt feature of semi-classical gravity? There's lots of evidence. There's lots of the number of people that have worked on this, that have stumbled upon this, that didn't possibly in your word too. There's a lot of ideas that essentially just sort of like were left there, and no one really followed up on them. So to conclude, you know, degravitation. So just reminding you of the first half of the talk. If degravitation is a phenomenological paradigm, if I just took these equations seriously, in terms of everything that they're saying, nonlinearly, and you understand that Bianchi identities are implied. You solve two of the cosmological constant problems and alleviate one of them. And of course, how you alleviate it depends on the precise filter function you look at. And what if you had a filter function that did something like this? So we had u to the m squared over box. In that case, then, when this goes to zero, this blows up. You have an exponential suppression of the cosmological constant on super horizon scales, then there's a lot going on. I don't know. It all depends on how you realize this. It's all 2.5, maybe I should update that to 2 1/100 aspects of the cosmological constant problem. And considering it as a semi-classical phenomenon resolves many of its conceptual difficulties. And a peculiar model, admittedly, that manifests non-trivial features in the IR can be used to engineer some sort of running of GNU that's desirable for us. And given this proof of concept, which is all this work is set out to do, is just having fun in some fictitious field theory space, could we realize this in a better underlying setup? And of course, we have to understand issues of scheme dependence. And I do think there are some actually very, very deep connections to other musings in the literature by these authors involving particle production or the trace anomalies and so on and so forth. So that's all I have to discuss this. Thank you very much.
So if we go back to your scalar field model with the e to the minus m squared of the box action, are you saying you want that to be the fundamental action of the scalar field?
Or no, the effective action that you then subsequently integrate out anyway. So the idea is you just have...
Why not?
Well, it could be. Well, I mean, the idea is this is some scalar field in, let's say, some dark sector. It doesn't couple to anything else. So if you're computing scanning amplitudes for any other sector, you should integrate this out anyway. So either perspective, I suppose. But I'd rather, I mean, in the context that I presented, this arises as the net effect of having done some resummation, non-perturbative resummations of the effective action of the scalar field phi, which I then subsequently integrate out the rest of it to compute how it renormalizes G Newton.
But I mean, I think there's no hope if this is just the effective action of a fundamental, quote, normal scalar field, because I think you just won't get factors like the
minus. No, you won't. No, and that's why I said this is supposed to be considered an effective. My perspective is that this is the net effect of having looked at the effective action of some scalar field. And by the way, I would like to stress, proof of concept, right? I think there are other things that will do it. I'm starting to see... I'm not saying that this is the way to do it, but I was just trying to engineer a cheeky field content that would do this for you to show that this is possible.
Right, but
but the motivation is clearly suspect. And
I would bet that it will only work if this is fundamental. But then, if it's fundamental, it's pretty peculiar. I mean, how do you define this action? Because the inverse co-ops needs boundary conditions.
Exactly. So, and if you'll notice that there's an essential singularity at a zero momentum.
Yep.
So you have to, you know, put in a cheeky one over. You have to regularize this in some way, and you have to worry about boundary conditions. And okay, so let me address that question. So this, if you were to write this action, is the following in the following limit. So limit epsilon squared goes to zero, integral of phi to the square minus. It's important that it's minimally coupled. Phi e to the minus m squared over box plus epsilon squared. Phi, right? But you're taking this limit later. This particular action propagates only massless quanta. Doesn't have any ghosts, right? There's no extra poles, and it's unitary. So it's a consistent thing.
It's an entire function.
It's an entire function. Yes.
This is the key. This is the key.
You don't want to introduce
ghosts.
Thing
I was doing in my paper.
Okay. Well, I'd be interested if you gave me some references. I'd be very interested in reading that.
One problem I have with this... sorry, John. Are you done?
Yeah.
Okay. So
once I'm done.
Yeah, that would be the day. But I have a problem with integrating out massless fields. Because apparently that's what you're doing, or I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure if you call it massless, but it's
it propagates massless quantum.
It's not massive.
It's not massive, no.
Yeah, and I mean the thing is, I mean, whenever you're integrating out something, you assume it's in its vacuum, and it's fine for massive fields because at low energies you don't have enough energy to excite them. So then it's safe to say that they're in vacuum.
You're saying that as a question of calculational ease. These calculations are possible when the thing is in its vacuum. But if it wasn't in its vacuum, you can do the calculations anyway. You still have an answer. And I can give you examples of specific backgrounds where that's not true. But please continue your question. I think I interrupted
you. Why should they be in the vacuum? There is nothing that...
It doesn't have to be in this case.
I mean, if you couple them to something...
It doesn't have
then
to
there
be.
Is, then they probably wouldn't be in the vacuum.
Right. It doesn't have to be. The point is, this is why I would like to put this field in the dark sector. Right? It doesn't, so the idea is this is a field that doesn't interact with anything else except gravity.
But still, even if it touches gravitationally, right. It won't be in this vacuum.
And it doesn't matter, because you can still evaluate this functional determinant, which I just did. It's an exact calculation. There's no approximation.
But you are integrating out phi.
Yes.
That. And that assumes this in its vacuum.
Nope.
Well, and then what does integrating out?
No. See, you're conflating doing a problem you can solve and generalizing that to all class of problems, right? You can do functional determinants in time-dependent backgrounds. I'll give you several examples. Particle production in a strong electric field, mm-hmm. right? It's a time-dependent background, but you're integrating the fermions out of it, right? And that's how you.
Fermions aren't.
They have an arbitrary spatial dependence. You're not assuming anything
so
about
that. I mean, that's an example.
It's a quadratic action. See, you can do this. You don't.
You're not integrating out fermions.
No, but I'm integrating out this field phi.
No, I mean in that example of Schrödinger.
Yes, you are. You're integrating out the fermions and trying to compute what the effective action is for the electric field, and look at its imaginary part, you find that
okay,
it's finite.
Okay,
that
is good.
They have to be massive. Thank you very
much. No.
Was it? It's got a massless charge. Massless charge,
for me? Okay, but I mean, at the level of doing the integrals, I don't think that's an issue.
But given what you're doing, you get an imaginary action, which is not really an action.
No. Oh, no, we're talking about particle production now in a strong electric field. No, what you're doing when you're trying to compute particle production in a strong electric field, right, is effectively if your action has an imaginary component, all that's telling you is that your transition element takes you from the vacuum to somewhere else. There's other fields being created, so this is not going to equal one. That's all I'm saying. It's effectively just capturing the fact that the path integral you've written down is a vacuum to vacuum amplitude. If you have vacuum to all other state amplitudes, you would recover precisely all the Bogle-Neubauer coefficients, right? But at the level of doing those functional determinants, you would notice all of that particle. So what you would then be computing is effectively the integral over phase space of all the Bogle-Neubauer coefficients. I believe there's a k, something like this. But you don't need to assume any time dependence. You're integrating the field outright no matter what they're doing. All field configurations enter that integration. It's just a Gaussian. It's just a Gaussian in this case.
Well, I think integrating that always assumes the vacuum. I don't understand the difference.
Maybe Nitmash is just saying that whatever answer you get will depend very strongly on what you assume about the initial conditions for this.
Yes. That's absolutely.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, given that, to claim that you kind of solve the cosmological constant, maybe in fact pushing the problem somewhere else, which is to say that with these initial and this interpretation of the problem games, that maybe I can do something.
That's definitely one worry. But like I said, I think that so my perspective on this is okay.
I would just sort of phrase this. Sort of very physically as following. Just please. Following a thought experiment.
Yeah.
Take it to sort of space.
Right.
Fixed lambda. Stick the scalar field on mm-hmm. it. Solve it. It's trivial. It's quadratic.
Mm-hmm.
So just find a general. No, it's not that trivial. It's one of the dots. But I.
It's doable. You can. The heat kernel integrals are.
You can solve the equations for the scalar field.
Yeah.
It's quadratic. Put in some initial condition for the scalar field.
I mean, classical scalar field.
Yeah, but it's actually quantum is trivial because it's quadratic, so you just do it with complex solutions of phi.
Mm-hmm.
And basically anything you want to compute quantum-mechanically, you do with a saddle point approximation to the action, which will be exact. So any quantum state you can evolve trivially just by solving a complex equation motion for the scalar field. So you just evolve the same. What's going to happen? Well, the energy will redshift away, and it will just become ground. You'll be left with exactly your lattices of vacuum. I just can't see anything.
But you're integrating out over all field configurations. You're saying that the
No, I wouldn't do that. I'd just say I pick my state for phi, I pick my geometry, and I evolve into the future. All the stress energy of phi is just going to redshift to nothing. And it won't affect the vacuum. I mean, that's the basic problem of the cosmological constant, is that we're trying to solve it from infrared effects. So they just redshift away.
Isn't that the claim that there could be some number two effect that visitor decays actually in this paper?
The only possibility for those are non-quadratic, so coming from non-quadratic actions, anything quadratic will just redshift.
But gravity is nonlinear. So I mean, this thing. Yeah.
So Antonio de Sattel started looking at cubic effects, and the whole thing becomes a technical nightmare, and there are 100-page papers, and then nobody agrees on what the answer is.
So at the quadratic level, you think that.
I don't think you'll ever discover anything interesting on the quadratic level.
But, I mean, this thing is rather singular in the infrared. Are you sure that it,
So the only way in which this might work is if you can stop the redshift thing away. That's all I can say. You've got to put some form of energy in there which doesn't redshift away because it has a sufficiently peculiar equation of motion that allows it to stay there even as the space is expanding exponentially. The local energy density says you need a funny equation.
I'm not entirely sure.
There's some equation of state there, which rho dot was not going to be negative. The basic problem is you've got this lambda wiping everything else out.
Well, I think the point here is not that the energy goes to zero, but that the energy doesn't gravitate anymore because the
constant goes to zero. Yes, so he wants this stuff to remain important. Right. I mean, if this is around,
Neil. What I want is when you look at loops in graviton, in the graviton propagator, they're always going to be there no matter what space time, what the background is doing. That they induce a running in once you get to large scales in just the purely gravitational sector. So I don't see what you're saying at all.
Well, okay. I thought you were saying that. Gravity to matter of this type.
Yes.
And this type of matter will be able to cancel.
No, what I'm saying is that is if you look at the graviton propagator and run scalar field loops through it, and look how it essentially worry at this problem at all scales, how it renormalizes the low energy gravitational couples, it causes G Newton times lambda to flow to zero. I don't see how this depends on
everything. It's supposed to be an effect of that price.
Zero point vacuum.
I mean, you always have particles go through loops independent of what solution you have. You always have.
You could think about it that way, or you could
I think you might be conflating this a little bit with people trying to dynamically relax the cosmological constant by sort of particle creation effects. I unfortunately got into using that kind of language to illustrate a point about effective field theory. But I really do mean that this is trying to generate an RG flow for G Newton in the infrared.
You can use that language, but I think in a simple way it's just...
The zero-point vacuum energy is causing trouble. That's what that is. The bubbles.
Yes, that is the vacuum.
Right, and that goes to zero too. That's annihilated by this filter.
Quantity dimension, vacuum polarization.
Yeah, it's all in here. That
so I think maybe.